Tonight we're looking again at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, a very difficult chapter it's been to look at, and we continue on with that in regards to marriage and separation, as well as divorce and remarriage. So I'm looking again at from verse 8, and I'll read to verse 16. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest, I say, I not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. But how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Sometimes I'm reluctant to commit myself to doing something, but next week I hope to look at how a wife is made holy because of her husband and an unbelieving husband made holy because of his wife, and then looking at the children in that case. I wonder if you've ever had any arguments or discussion with your children about the difference between what is legal and what is moral. My children like to push the right buttons and get a reaction from Dad or Mum. And more often from Mum than Dad, I would think. But so they turn 18, for instance. Oh, Mum, we can drink as much as we like. And we could even get drunk if we want to. It's all legal. And then, of course, they pulled the chain, they get the reaction they're after, and a bit of a sermon about that's not the will of God, and we shouldn't be doing those kinds of things. The same thing might be a concern going to a casino. Hey, Mum, I can go to a casino and gamble. And again, they would get a reaction from both of us about it might be legal, but it's not morally right. And they get a bit of a, you know, they have a smirk on their face as they get the reaction thereafter. They know exactly what Marion and I will say when they say things like that. But there's a difference between what is legal and what is moral. When the children were younger, I kept on trying to teach them about zebra crossings. I explained to them that you have a right of way when you go on a zebra crossing, and that a car must stop. But I said, I first want you to look, before you cross, at the eyes of the driver coming towards you to make sure there's eye contact there and that they acknowledge your existence before you cross the zebra crossing. And sometimes they would argue with me, but they're in the wrong if they were to hit me. And I said, well, they might be legally wrong, but how are you going to yell from heaven that they are so? Isn't it better to be to just take that little precaution, even though you legally can do whatever? And so that's something that you try to teach them. See the driver, make sure that you see their eyes, and then you can safely cross. That is a good thing to do. The government might say to women wanting an abortion, it's all legal. And we say, but is it moral? They're the questions that we face. But the strange thing is that when it comes to marriage, separation, divorce and remarriage, we are so often more concerned about the legality of things than the morality of things. What is the will of God for marriage should be the overriding question in our mind, not whether it's that something legal has happened. And yet so often as a church in its history are far too concerned with the legalities and the grounds for divorce and so on. Now, I think that when I was younger, I was a bit more legalistic than I am today. I sort of hope that I'm a bit less so. Not sure, but I think I'm less legalistic than I used to be. So I have a male relative who is divorced, and his wife was unfaithful to him. And my temptation then is to think to myself, well, that's good. He's now free to divorce and get married because she was unfaithful to him, and that meets the grounds that Jesus mentioned in the scripture. That's a really legal way of looking at things. I have a female relative who's also divorced. Her husband was also unfaithful to her. And again, you think to yourself, well, that's good. At least, you know, Jesus says, apart from sexual immorality, I don't want you to divorce. And so again, meets the grounds, free in my mind, to remarry. But like I said, I think I was very legalistic about it. You see, when I was growing up in Queensland, the church was completely, there was a huge problem in our church. There was a man who continued to bash his wife. Now, I'm sure I was only young. I lived in that, I was part of that community from the age of 4 till about 17. And it must have occurred in my younger time there. But a man bashed his wife continually. I don't mean every day, but maybe every 3 weeks in a month. Eventually, she left him. She remarried another person, had children with that person, and moved to another country. I'm not sure which order of things it was, but that's basically what happened. But the church was divided. Well, that doesn't meet the qualifications for divorce. That's not sexual immorality. Is that woman living in New Zealand, therefore, living in an adulterous relationship with her, with a man who can't really be her husband because she hasn't legitimately sort of separated from the first husband who bashed her constantly? You get in all sorts of knots about these things. And there was two large families in the church, and one family had, there was one of the participants to this quarrel and another family the other. And it was a big thing. People trying to work out if bashing someone, a husband bashing his wife, if that was a good enough ground for divorce. Some people would say separation is then the answer, not divorce, but I don't think that's true at all. I would say that's looking in that particular case at whether things are legal, not moral. And in church history, it's been like that. Well-meaning ministers and sessions and churches have said to a woman whose husband has attempted to murder her that she ought to return to the house and just take her life in her own hands and trust God in that situation. And if the husband has threatened to murder the kids, the same thing goes then. So it's a very difficult area, the church trying to do the right thing, but have we understood it properly? And so it's a difficult topic because we want to be consistent and we want to understand the words of God clearly. So I want to begin by saying, what is biblical marriage? I use the word biblical marriage because I think that as time goes on here in Australia, we'll be using the word biblical marriage as opposed to legal marriage probably more and more, because society has rechanged the whole word for marriage, and it seems that the writing is on the wall that one day it will be between people of same sexes. So we'll probably end up using the words biblical marriage. What is biblical marriage? And I dare say that it is that if I asked that question of you, what is marriage or what is biblical marriage, you would come up with a whole lot of answers. If you did a survey of 100 people, you might all have slightly different answers. To some, it's a passionate relationship, sort of with romantic and sexual connotations. To some, it would be the sharing of their lives that complement and enrich each other. Some think of marriage in terms of children or even grandchildren. Some think of marriage in terms of security. And certainly in many parts of the world, that would be a part of what is involved in marriage. For some, it would involve the thought of settling down with another person. But if I were to interview all of you here tonight and say, what is marriage? I don't think any of you would come back to me and give me a legal definition of marriage. I don't think you would look at marriage as two people going down to a solicitor and signing some papers, binding them together. I don't think anyone here would give me that definition for marriage. So what is a Christian marriage? And I think it involves three things, but it's based on the verses of the Bible, Genesis 2:24, Matthew 19, verse 6, and Ephesians 5:31. That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife and they become one flesh. Matthew 19. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Ephesians 5:31. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So I think there's three important things that come out of those texts in regards to what marriage is and what we should be seeking in marriage. The first one is the establishment of a new home together, a separate home from your parents or wherever you're living currently. It's an establishing a new home. The second thing is that he leaves cleaved sticks to his wife, and they live in a permanent relationship. Thirdly, they become one flesh. Intimacy and the sharing of their lives. To me, they're the three important things that make up biblical marriage. And if one is missing, it doesn't, if you like, qualify as a marriage, and we would be concerned very much about that. Now, neither the Old Testament or New Testament require any legal documents to be signed. It was all very easy in those days. You didn't have to save $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. She would just move in. So there's Isaac standing at the door of his tent. And he sees Rebecca coming into the distance. Never met her before. Opens the door of his tent, she moves in, and these three things happen, and they're married. Pretty easy in those days. Didn't cost anything at all. When Ruth married Boaz, or Boaz married Ruth, there was a celebration, but there was no signing of any documents at that time. It was only in 1753... in Britain, that an act was passed, that's 250 years ago, called this Act for the Prevention of Clandestine Marriages. Act for the Prevention of Clandestine Marriages. And after this, a kind of ceremony and legal things took place. So again, just have those three things in your mind in regards to marriage. This is what marriage involves. the creation of a separate household, the permanence of the relationship, and the one flesh union. Okay, just have those things in your mind. And those things are enshrined in the marriage vows that a couple make together at a church or in a ceremony. I promise to love, cherish you, look after you, sometimes obey you, honour you, worship you, etc., etc., for as long as we both shall live. At a wedding ceremony, you never hear the couple say, according to the Marriage Act 1984, I promise, under clause 142, 145 and 148, to be married to you. I have never heard that yet at a wedding ceremony. It's the content that is important, not the legality as far as that goes. Death, according to the Bible, brings an end to that marriage relationship because there can't be any of those three things. The three things mentioned. Those things cease to exist at death. So what then of divorce and separation? In Matthew 19, we read of Jesus' reaction to the question of divorce. Some Pharisees approached him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife on any grounds? Haven't you read, he replied, that he who created them in the beginning male made them male and female. And he also said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. The Pharisees were asking that legal question. On what grounds can you separate from your wife? In today's terms, we include the wife in the discussion. But what does Jesus say to them? We shouldn't be talking, this is how I would picture it, we shouldn't be talking about what grounds to divorce, but that God made you into a one flesh union and you should be concentrating on your marriages. The Pharisees were just interested in how to get out of something. And yet Jesus brings them back to the purposes of God and says you should be working at what you have committed yourself to, living in a way that is biblically honest. And that is the establishment of the new home, the permanent relationship and the intimacy involved. Sadly, the church has often felt okay with people moving out, separating, but not divorcing. But Jesus is very keen that people do not separate. That is the heart of what he said. They're talking about divorce. Jesus is talking about separation. Let them, let no one separate. If a person was to come to this church and say they have struggles in their marriage, or if a couple separates, it's not the divorce papers that should concern us, but the separation that should concern us. And brothers and sisters, in your marriages, are these things vitally important to you? The three things. Living in an intimate relationship, cleaving and being honest, and holding firmly to your wife and living together in the one home. Is that important to you? So when is divorce possible? The Pharisees asked Jesus the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife on any grounds? And sometimes we as Christians can spend time thinking about the grounds of why someone is divorcing or someone has separated. The Westminster Confession of Faith says it this way, chapter 24. Yet nothing but adultery or such willful desertion as can in no way be remedied by the church or civil magistrate is cause sufficient of dissolving the bond of marriage. According to the Westminster Confession of Faith, only two grounds for separation and divorce: adultery and separation, or willful desertion. Sorry. I would say that this is very restrictive. And in a sense, I would say that Westminster Confession of Faith is wrong. And I could never sign such a document on that ground. It's very restrictive, and I believe not true to what the Bible says. In the past, I've preached from Matthew 5, 31 and 32. And I've said in the sermons that I've preached on this, on that text, that Jesus never uses the word adultery. He uses another word called porneia. And the word porneia simply means serious conduct that can destroy a marriage. Serious misconduct that can destroy a marriage. And so I don't believe that adultery is the only ground, but any kind of serious misconduct that can destroy a marriage. And even though the translators of the Bible like to put in the word sexual misconduct or adultery, I think they're wrong. The word is porneia, a far wider word, has far wider meaning in Greek than simply sexual immorality. If a woman is bashed, I think she has every right to leave her husband because he has broken the one flesh union. If there's an attempted murder from one spouse to another, of course that person can leave because it is a serious misconduct in regards to the marriage. That person doesn't love his wife as he loves himself. And this brings us then to our passage in 1 Corinthians 7. And there we read to the married, verse 10, and I'm reading from the Christian Standard Bible. To the married I give this command, not I but the Lord. A wife is not to leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife, but I, not the Lord, say to the rest, if any brother has an unbelieving wife and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her, and so on. Well, brothers and sisters, I don't see the Bible as contradicting itself. And I believe that Paul is quite aware of the words that Jesus said in Matthew 5, Matthew 19, were verses that we've already looked at tonight. We have to understand what Paul is saying here. And I think that the Bible has always allowed for remarriage. When we read Paul's verses here, we think to ourselves, but he's saying not. But I put it to you that perhaps he's not saying that at all. So let's just begin there. Deuteronomy 24, Moses says this. If a man, chapter 24, if a man marries a woman, but she becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, he may write her a divorce certificate, hand it to her, and send her away from his house. If after leaving his house she goes and becomes another man's wife, etc., etc. Now she is the guilty party in that. We don't know what she's done, but let's pretend she's the guilty party. But nowhere does Moses say that she's not another man's wife. He says that she is another man's wife. So obviously the Old Testament allows for the possibility of remarriage, no matter who the guilty party is. But then we still have to reconcile ourselves to 1 Corinthians 7. So again we read, to the married I give this charge, not I but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. They have no trouble with the translation here. But I think we have to understand what Paul is saying. I think this is a short-term measure. Paul is writing to people that are considering separation, considering divorce. And Paul is saying to them, just wait a minute. Do all you can not to terminate the relationship. Hold on. Seek to be reconciled to your husband. Seek to restore the three things mentioned. One household. Cleave to your wife or husband. Be intimate with your wife and husband. Seek to restore your relationship to what it ought to be. But if you do separate, then it's back to verse 8 of the chapter. And so let me just put that into sort of a framework. It's very much similar to what a Christian counsellor would say today. Work out your marriage and try to be reconciled. This is your first priority. Secondly, if this does not work out, if this works out well and good and is pleasing to God. However, if you cannot be reconciled, then it's back to verse 8 and 9. And what do we read in verse 8 and 9? To the unmarried and widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn. But I just want to change that, as I mentioned last week. I don't think it's a very good translation from the ESV. I would say it should read this way, verse 8. To the previously married and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain as I am. But if they do not exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn, and then in hell. Quite a different translation. The previously married, who are the widows and the divorced. Get married if you find someone to love. And that makes best sense of Jesus' words in Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, as well as in Moses in Deuteronomy 24. Now, what I've said is different, I would think, than what you've ever probably heard before. But it makes sense of how we see things, how things actually happen in life. Marriage is a precious gift from God, but it doesn't always work out. And people do separate for all kinds of reasons and sadly get divorced. And it's probably the most traumatic thing that can ever happen to a person. When I look at the life of my own relatives as a pastor in a church and getting to meet people going through it, it's about the most traumatic thing that can ever happen in your life. But the words I'm saying seem to make sense to me in regards to what is the reality of life. But brothers and sisters, just to conclude on the proper note, there are three things to marriage. To leave your father and mother behind. To cleave to your wife or husband. And to share with them in an intimate way that is uniquely personal. This is what constitutes a marriage, biblical speaking. Anything less than that is not pleasing to God. Anything less than that is not pleasing to God. If a couple separates and lives in a different home, that is not what marriage is all about, and we can't be happy with it. At least they didn't get divorced, we might say, but that's ridiculous. God is not happy with separation. God is not happy when a husband and wife live in different rooms in the same house because they cannot stand each other. God is not happy with the forced politeness that so often happens in a family when husband and wife determine we'll still live together, but we don't need to talk together, or we don't need to communicate together. God is not happy with any of that. God is not happy when a wife says, I refuse you, husband, any intimacy. And God is not happy with a husband who refuses his wife intimacy. And God is not happy with people that just live together but don't interact together. All these things are displeasing to God, because none of them reflect Christ's love for his church, which is what marriage is all based on, this sacrificial love of God for his church. And if you know from tonight that your marriage is struggling, then it's time to repent. It's time to be reconciled. Now, this is what Paul is saying. He's pleading with the Corinthians to work on their marriages. Jesus said, what God has brought together, let no man separate. Jesus has an undying love for his church, and our marriages have to mirror that undying love for the church. And where we need to ask for forgiveness, we must ask God and our spouse. And we must do all we can to be reconciled and at peace with our spouse, for this is the will of God. And we all fail in marriage. I always think it's the most amazing relationship that two people can actually put up with each other in love. Most people get sick of me after a while, and yet she puts up with me. It's an amazing thing. And I'm surprised when I look at you that your wife puts up with you as well. It's an amazing thing. This unique relationship that God created for us to enjoy. And it's precious. But so often we're satisfied with what is less than what marriage is. And this is displeasing to God. Amen.